Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Lucy Lawless, and I'm a Kiwi from Auckland, New Zealand.
In a time of ancient gods, she was Xena, a mighty princess forged in the heat of battle.
With sincere apology to Lucy Lawless, part of me will never outgrow the 90s and Xena warrior princess. I mean, the power, the passion, and now the pandemic.
There were two lockdowns of 2 weeks each from memory. Other than that, we lived completely normal lives while you were all suffering just the horrible progression of the virus in your society. We had stadiums and sports and weddings and you name it, we had it all.
The we in this case is New Zealand, and they did have it all after those very strict lockdowns. New Zealand, in fact, had some of the strictest lockdowns in the world. And Lawless says she's proud of New Zealanders, especially those in the largest city of Auckland, where the toughest restrictions took place. That pride wasn't shared everywhere, though. Once, while traveling to a remote part of New Zealand, Lawless was in a pub, and she found herself at odds with another customer.
And I said, I want a bit of respect from my city because Aucklanders locked down really hard and we beat it. Not just for ourselves, but we did it for the rest of the country. We're really concerned about not spreading it around. So I want a little bit of bloody respect from you. Thank you very much. And he was really like taken aback that I challenged him on it. I think for the most part, Aucklanders take it for the team because they are where the main airport is. And they've done a really bloody great job. It's just, you know, a few stupid apples.
For a year and a half, New Zealand pursued a COVID zero strategy. The weeks of lockdowns, the border closures, they came spectacularly close to total COVID elimination. The country has one of the lowest case rates in the world. In the last 18 months, there have only been 27 deaths in New Zealand. And outside of those heavy lockdowns, Kiwis have lived mostly restriction-free. But that is about to change because Auckland has been in another 7-week lockdown. And last week, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern admitted that in order to fully beat back the Delta variant, New Zealand would have to move to its highest alert level. And she was not prepared to do that.
For this outbreak, it's clear that long periods of heavy restrictions has not got us to zero cases. But that is okay. Elimination was important because we didn't have vaccines. Now we do, so we can begin to change the way we do things.
So I'm Dr. Susie Wiles. I am an associate professor at the University of Auckland in New Zealand.
Susie Wiles is a microbiologist and science communicator.
When the Prime Minister made her announcement, it was an acknowledgement, I think, that I recognised that we were transitioning away from elimination to hard suppression at a time that is really difficult. So I was hoping we'd make that transition when there were no cases in the community and we had everybody vaccinated. Instead, we're making that transition when we have COVID in our community and we don't have enough people vaccinated.
In fact, fewer than half of Kiwis 12 and older have been vaccinated, putting New Zealand far behind comparative nations. Wiles says she's grieving New Zealand's strategic shift.
The thing that's sad is we know it doesn't have to be this way. That's what the New Zealand story has told us, is there were ways to prevent this, but they were hard things to do. And, you know, yeah, and they're things that just some parts of society find really difficult.
The lockdowns are difficult. Earlier this month, thousands of people broke a stay-at-home order in Auckland to demonstrate against restrictions. It was New Zealand's largest protest of the pandemic. So today, we're going to take a look at what's happening in nations that had aimed for COVID zero. What is their strategy now? And what's driving the shift? And what does it tell us about how to end the pandemic, or safely shift into COVID as an endemic disease globally and here in the United States? Well, let's turn now to Singapore and speak with Dale Fisher. He's an infectious disease physician at National University Hospital in Singapore and chair of the WHO's Global Outbreak Alert and Response Network Steering Committee. Dr. Fisher, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magna. Good to be here.
So first of all, can you give us a quick picture of what the COVID situation right now is in Singapore?
So right now we're moving phases, as you just described in New Zealand. We're probably a few months ahead of those because it was actually August 29 we hit 80% of the entire population was fully vaccinated, which is 90% of those above 12. So we felt that it was time to move from, we never really had COVID zero, but we had keep it really low. We didn't mind if there were a few cases because we had systems in place to get back to zero. But so we never did that panicking, as you see in other countries, as soon as they had a case type thing. But now we're at 3,000 plus cases a day. Our population's about 5.5 million, and we're having deaths every day now. And if you reflect back to maybe mid-August, we'd had 50,000, 60,000 cases for the whole pandemic, and deaths for the whole pandemic were about 30. So now we're over 110, I think, deaths, and as I said, 3,000 cases a day. So things are chugging along because the strategy's evolved.
Okay, so help me understand then what direction the evolution is taking, because just to be clear, you said that it was what, 80, more than 80% of people over the age of 12 in Singapore have been vaccinated?
Yeah, that milestone was reached on August 29. It's about 5% more now.
Okay, so a very large percentage then. And yet there's still the, 3,000, did you say 3,000 cases a day?
Correct.
A day. Okay, so obviously not a COVID zero strategy at all. But is, then what is the, or COVID zero outcome, I should say. So what, but what is, what are the current state of restrictions? What is life like on a daily basis in Singapore?
So we've still got quite a lot of restrictions left over from when we were at that low COVID point. So through most of August, we had double digit cases a day, and through most of the pandemic, we've had single digit and several zero case days. All we did really in August was to allow in-restaurant dining again, really. We eased some of the border restrictions and some of the approaches to gyms and other things. But the main one we changed was, instead of takeaway only, you are now allowed to have five vaccinated people in a restaurant or hawker stall. And that really saw our numbers go from under 100 to over 1,000 in a month.
That one change. Well, so it still sounds like, to my ear here in the United States, Dr. Fisher, it still sounds like daily life is quite restricted in Singapore. Is that right?
Well, not in terms of businesses.
Okay.
I'm not sure of the state with nightclubs. They're usually the last to come back online. But things are open. They've been open through all but about 6 or 8 weeks of a bad time in the middle of last year. So businesses are open. Most of the time children have gone to school. So it's been quite normal. But, yeah, the obvious visible difference is you can't go anywhere without wearing a mask, and people can't get together in large groups. And that was the middle-of-the-road strategy. You heard in New Zealand they would swing from very sort of stringent restrictions if there were any cases, and then when there were no cases, that have 50,000 people at the rugby. So we never did those extremes. It was just sort of, with mask wearing and limiting numbers, even if there is a case sneaks through the border, then we know it won't spread.
I see. Okay. So very important distinction then. So is this, what do we call this in Singapore? Is this a living with COVID kind of strategy there?
Well, the aim, we got, some would say, lost our nerve a couple of weeks ago when the numbers really just skyrocketed. If you look at the epi curve, it's very impressive what's happened in the last month to go from double digits to 3,000 cases. So because we weren't really sure of the impact that would have on hospitals, we tightened up again, which was two people at restaurants. But things are plateauing off, and I think most of us are looking forward to an easing of restrictions over the next month or two. But this is a very sort of sensitized population with so few deaths and so few cases for so long, and telling people that we must contain at all cases and being successful at it, it's very difficult messaging to now saying, look, we're getting a few deaths every day, we're getting thousands of cases, but now it's okay. And of course, you and I know it's okay because of vaccination, and we have to move on. But nonetheless, the community is still, I guess, left wondering, why is everything different now?
That is absolutely fascinating, Dr. Fisher, because for all the reasons that you just said, I think early on in the pandemic, and correct me if I'm wrong, because it's been a long 18 months, but Singapore was held up as an example of, first of all, sort of multifaceted pandemic controls being implemented across a population, and then also for its very, very effective public health communication. Is that right, if I remember correctly?
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. And I think, but give or take a few speed humps we've all had through the pandemic, Singapore has done very well. But this transition phase is very tricky. It's hard completely flipping your message. We all know why, but the average person on the street or sitting on his veranda is wondering why there's so many cases. And of course, the answer to that is the vaccine doesn't stop transmission very well. It just stops severe disease.
And stops you from dying, too. So, Dr. Dale Fisher in Singapore, stand by for just a moment. We are taking kind of a global tour today of countries that had aimed either for COVID elimination or very remarkable COVID suppression, and where they are now and what their new goals are and what that says for what we should do here in the United States. We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today we're taking a look at what's happening in countries that had aimed for COVID zero or a very, 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 very effective COVID suppression strategy and what those nations are doing now. We talked a little bit earlier about New Zealand that had been pretty successful, very, very strong lockdowns, then reopening. They had low COVID numbers, but Delta is making that challenging now. And so they are shifting away from some of the most severe lockdowns that we've seen worldwide. And we've got a lot of comments here coming in about the New Zealand story. Patrick Farrell says, they never had a chance of getting rid of it, and thinking otherwise was silly. Too endemic, too widespread, and too easily transmitted. Unless New Zealand was willing to cut off their nation for years and years, a zero COVID strategy was nonsense. Hector Acevedo says, they did a much better job than we did. Good leadership was the difference. We're going to go back to Singapore here in just a second, but let's look for a moment at what's been going on in Hong Kong, because Hong Kong has worked hard over the last 18 months to eliminate COVID. They've had great success, too. Zero cases over the last few months. But the major difference is that, unlike New Zealand, Hong Kong has no plans of abandoning their zero COVID plan for now. Ben Cowling is an epidemiologist at the University of Hong Kong, but he says it is time for Hong Kong to shift strategies.
And I am concerned that the impact is going to become more and more apparent as time goes on, in terms of unemployment, in terms of issues with the loss of GDP from travel, from tourism, the impact on the airlines and so on. I mean, from my preference as an expat is really to follow Singapore, to start to relax the measures, to gradually reopen, to allow international travel, because Hong Kong's been called Asia's world city. And you can't be Asia's world city if you stay behind a firewall, behind a travel ban on visitors, 2 to 3 week quarantine for returning residents.
In fact, when we spoke with Cowling, he was on his way back to Hong Kong and about to experience that key part of Hong Kong's zero COVID strategy.
Yes, so I'm actually at the airport right now. My flight is in 2 hours. I've been in the UK for a month. And when I get back to Hong Kong, I need to go to quarantine for 3 weeks. I'm going to stay in a hotel room, the size of your bedroom, probably, with an ensuite bathroom. And I'm not allowed to leave that room. The hotel will bring me food, will bring me change of sheets and towels and so on. But I'm stuck there for 3 weeks. And actually, that's longer than necessary. We know that the incubation period for COVID is rarely longer than a week. Maybe it can go up to 10 days or 14 days at the most. But for various reasons, the Hong Kong government's decided to be really, really strict. But it's tough. I'm not looking forward to the next 3 weeks.
Ben Cowling is a professor of infectious disease epidemiology at the University of Hong Kong. Let's hear more from Dale Fisher. He's been joining us from Singapore, infectious disease physician at National University Hospital in Singapore and chair of the WHO's Global Outbreak Alert and Response Network Steering Committee. So, Dr. Fisher, let me just get your sense about what you think of the assertion that Ben Cowling made there, that even going for COVID zero to begin with, places like Hong Kong or New Zealand may not have been a realistic strategy. What's your response to that?
Listen, I think the key words were to begin with, and I would argue that suppression and going for zero or keeping it close to zero is good. The bottom line is you just have to look at the lives saved, basically, and the hospital's overwhelmed. And once a hospital's overwhelmed, then actually more people die than have to. So I think it was important at one stage, but now you have to let the vaccine take you out of it. You can only say that suppression or zero COVID is good if you have an exit plan. And I look at some parts of Australia, I look at China, I look at Hong Kong, and staying zero COVID means basically everyone has to do what Ben's about to do, which is you can't enter that country without 2 or in that case 3 weeks. And you can't run a society that way for economic reasons, for social reasons. And we've got a very good vaccine, and you just have to get to a certain level and then say, okay, we need to live with it. It was mentioned earlier that New Zealand had to stop their zero COVID because of Delta, but I would argue it's not about Delta. It's just that it's not feasible to keep your borders closed indefinitely. And unless you eradicate it from the whole world, which is not feasible, then you have to join the rest of the world and you have to have your day of reckoning. And your day of reckoning is you let it in, you have a lot of cases, you have the pain that the US and Europe had last year, except you've got a vaccine to support you. But you have to have this transition and live with COVID.
Okay. So I'm so, so glad that we have you today, Dr. Fisher, because I hear everything that you're saying, the need for an exit strategy, essentially. And at the same time, as you were saying before the break, in Singapore, there is also this sort of period of uncertainty with communication, right? Because you said that Singaporeans are kind of wondering, wait, we've done all this work, we have a vaccine, why do we still have so many cases? So what would you couple with that exit strategy in order to allow people to understand sort of what the new goals are, what the new path is, why seeing some cases would be okay?
So risk communications and community engagement is a whole science that's closely linked to outbreak response. Any outbreak response that doesn't do well, whether it's Ebola or H1N1 or yellow fever or plague, whatever it is, you need to be able to communicate with the public well. And that doesn't mean you can, it's a done deal. You do it well, therefore it's settled. You have to do multiple influences from politicians to health authorities to academics to footballers and actors. And you have to go through multiple media, whether that's social media, newspaper, TV, radio, and you have to give it time. You have to let a conversation take place. You have to let people get angry on social media. You have to let them understand that there's sense to this, and this just doesn't happen overnight in any setting.
It doesn't happen overnight. And I would say in the United States, it doesn't happen even after months and months and months and months. I mean, so from your view from Singapore, how would you assess what's been going on here in the United States since the beginning of this year and the start of the Biden administration?
Well, I don't really like to comment on other countries too much because there's different challenges in any setting, but I don't think many would deny that there was a fair bit of chaos through 2020. I guess the upside of the chaos is that people became a lot more tolerant of a bad situation and therefore you're coming out of the pandemic sooner, if you like, than us that are still trying to convince people to live with it. But the flip side in the US is you're a very heterogeneous country, and the vaccine rates vary from, I think, 30-something percent up into the 70s. So some states are I believe, going to have a rough winter still. So while it's apparently over to most people, I would argue there's still going to be pockets of sort of large clusters in various parts of the state.
Well, Dr. Fisher, you're just going to have to forgive me because I cannot resist. I've been on something of a journey to understand what the goals are for COVID control in the United States. And I'll be perfectly honest that my last interview with Dr. Anthony Fauci from a couple of months ago left me feeling more than a little frustrated because I asked him clearly, what should the United States be aiming for? Give us some numbers, daily case numbers, R-naught, whatever, pick your metric, I said to Dr. Fauci, and he just wouldn't do it. Now, this is from an interview in May of this year, so out of fairness, let's listen to a big chunk of what Dr. Fauci told me back then.
We're not going to eradicate this year, and it's very likely we're going to eliminate it. But what I do know we're going to do, we're going to be able to control it. And the situation is, at what level of control is society going to be able to get back to as close to normal as you possibly can?
Yeah. So first of all, full disclosure, like my master's degree is in environmental science and risk management. So these risk questions are I can't help but to ask them. I really can't. But I hear you very strenuously trying to not answer a question here. So let me rephrase it. You're advising the Biden administration.
Yeah.
And certainly the Biden administration, I know they're thinking about these questions because they've got to make announcements. They got to communicate to the people, the CDC, et cetera. What are you advising them on what they ought to be aiming for regarding getting how we're going to know when COVID is under control?
Well, you know, that's right. And I'm not, Magna, I'm smiling because you're saying that I'm trying very hard not to answer your question. I am answering your question. We don't know what that number is. We don't know what a number will be when you're going to have such control that people are going to feel comfortable about going out. I mean, we could give you a real number when there's no infection, when you've actually controlled it so that there are essentially so few infections, you could barely count them. But we don't know if that's going to be the case with the dynamics. Then as the weeks go by and you get more and more people vaccinated and less infections, there's going to be more liberalization about who can, how many people can be in a ballpark to watch a game. What about indoor dining? What about going back to the workplace? Mm-hmm. You're going to start to see gradual liberalization of those guidelines associated with the continued diminution of the number of cases, which will be profoundly influenced by the number of people who get vaccinated.
Okay.
And that's why I say, and you think I'm being evasive, I'm not, let's all get vaccinated and you'll know it when you see it.
That's Dr. Anthony Fauci on this program, May 2021. And by the way, you can hear the full interview at onpointradio.org. So, Dr. Fisher, in Singapore, I know you're reluctant to talk about specifically what's happening here in the United States, but let me just put it this way then. A minute or two ago, you also said that people need to learn to live with it, to live with COVID. So, ideally, what does that look like? How would you define that?
Well, if you want one metric, it's vaccination rates. It's pure, plain and simple. It is so much more lethal and severe and threatening to your healthcare system if you don't have vaccination to help you live with it. You saw what happened through 2020. That's called living with it when you don't have vaccination. So if you want to put the odds in your favor, you simply have to get vaccinated. And you can look at the vaccine levels at a high sort of national level. You can look at them at a state level. But I fear if you look at them at a city or township level, you're going to find some really horrible pockets. And those little towns with one rural hospital are going to be extremely under threat just with a few hundred people getting COVID next year in an unvaccinated setting. So I think that's the metric you need to look for is widespread high vaccination rates. Remember, most people being vaccinated doesn't help the unvaccinated. They can still transmit it. So you don't take the vaccine for the community or your family, you really take it for yourself, and you're much more likely to survive COVID because it's coming back. When people start closing their windows and doors and you know, huddling up because it's winter, the safe distancing goes because you're not running around outside and COVID's coming back. So I think that's how you live with it, really.
Well, Dale Fisher is an infectious disease physician at National University Hospital in Singapore and chair of the WHO's Global Outbreak Alert and Response Network Steering Committee, speaking to us today from Singapore. Dr. Fisher, thank you so very much.
My pleasure, Magna.
All right, so let's ground this back here in the United States. And joining me now from Boston is Joseph Allen. He's director of the Healthy Buildings Program and an associate professor at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Professor Joe Allen, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Meg. Now, always a pleasure to join you.
And also with us today from New York is Celine Gounder, infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist at New York University and Bellevue Hospital, host of the Epidemic and American Diagnosis podcasts, and was a member of the Biden-Harris Transition COVID-19 Advisory Board. Dr. Gounder, welcome to you.
Great to be here.
So let me just ask you both, first of all, to give us your assessments of what you heard in our little trip to New Zealand, Singapore, and Hong Kong. And Dr. Gander, I'll start with you. How do you measure what's been happening in those countries now and as they shift or evolve their COVID strategies?
Well, I do think it's important to divide the response into pre-vaccine versus post-vaccine strategies. Your strategies are going to be different. And I think they were quite successful in using all of the mitigation measures available to them at the time before we had vaccines to really suppress transmission, to suppress the number of hospitalizations and deaths, to protect their healthcare system. But necessarily, you do have to start to reframe things to change your strategy once you have a vaccine. And I think Dr. Fisher's comments there towards the end about, you know, your metric really needs to be around vaccination uptake coverage. That's really what we need to be focusing on now, in addition to some of the other things that we can do to reduce risk further, which Dr. Allen can speak to in more detail, but around things like ventilation and air filtration.
Joe Allen, let me get your take as well on a similar question, but I'll phrase it a little bit differently before we talk about mitigation strategies. So in New Zealand, they had, you know, they were aiming for COVID zero, and per Dr. Gounder's point, very successful until relatively recently. So they're going to start, you know, relaxing their lockdowns, even though they have a comparatively lower vaccination rate, that less than 50% that I talked about earlier. Then we heard from Singapore that has really high vaccination rates and is kind of in this live with it scenario, as we heard Dale Fisher talk about. And then we have Hong Kong. Very good job at controlling COVID, has no plans on abandoning right now incredibly profound restrictions. What are the three kind of very different takes tell you about how countries have been trying to navigate the post-vaccination period?
Well, I think Dr. Gounder has it exactly right that we have to break this down into what worked prior to vaccines and what works now. And I think what we're seeing in these countries, and maybe this period that feels confusing again, is that the strategies need to shift. So clearly, the zero COVID strategy worked really well in New Zealand. Look at the deaths versus what we've seen in the United States. But at this point, as vaccines come online and are widespread in Singapore, Hong Kong, New Zealand, and everywhere else, it's clear that the strategy has to change. One, there are social pressures here. Think Singapore. I mean, you're not going to have 80, 85% of people vaccinated and tolerating, quite honestly, intense restrictions on what they can and can't do because the vaccines protect you from severe disease and death. And this gets to an article I wrote with Dr. Helen Jenkins at Boston University School of Public Health in the New York Times just a little bit ago about goal setting. Mm-hmm. What are we actually trying to prevent? And I think these countries are in that phase. Is the goal zero COVID? Well, that's not going to be possible. Is the goal, as I think it should be, to reduce the impact on severe disease, death, and the toll that our healthcare system has taken in the U.S. And we're not having that discussion, as your interview with Dr. Fauci made clear. The administration is not being clear about what our goals are. Once we set those goals, the American public, for the most part, is willing to make some of these sacrifices to reach them. I think many people have felt that we've reached some of these goals. We're highly vaccinated in some regions of the country. And so I think other countries are feeling what we're feeling in the U.S., and they're at different stages.
Okay. So we've got about a minute before the break. Let me just hear quickly from both of you on this about vaccination as a metric. I'm looking right now at some recent numbers. Ages 12 and up in the United States, as far as I can see, we've had 76% of Americans receiving at least one dose, ages 12 and up, roughly 66% fully vaccinated. It's not at the 80%+ we were talking about in Singapore. But Celine Gounder, I mean, is that enough or approaching close to enough to really sort of fully open up the country to a post-pandemic reality?
Meghna, we probably need to be hitting something more like 80-85% of people vaccinated, first of all. And I think, second of all, those numbers really hide that there's a lot of patchiness in who's vaccinated and who's not.
Okay. And Joe Allen, I'm going to give you 10 seconds to give you your quick take on that.
Same thing. I don't think it's enough. And this is why I've been urging vaccine mandates. I think if we look even at what's happening in New Zealand, they're going to have to do that. That's the only way to push the needle, push this further along, because the voluntary approach eventually hits its limit.
Well, we are talking about lessons now that the United States can learn from different COVID control efforts in places like New Zealand, Singapore, and Hong Kong, and what we here as a nation should be aiming for to really get past this pandemic. We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university. shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we are going to be talking about happiness, right? We all have a right to happiness. We all actually deserve it. And we'll be speaking with Dr. Lori Santos. She's a psychology professor at Yale. She teaches one of the university's most popular classes on the science of happiness. So we want to hear from you with everything going on in the world. And, you know, today we're talking about COVID yet again. Have you struggled to achieve happiness lately? What are the things that you think are holding you back from being happy? Do you feel like you don't even deserve to be happy? And for folks out there who actually are saying, no, happiness should be mine, and it is, what have you been doing to achieve that happiness? Tell us your stories at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are once again talking about COVID, this time taking a look at countries such as New Zealand, Singapore, Hong Kong, who had very different COVID control strategies all the way to attempting COVID elimination, and what lessons we can learn from that here in the United States as those nations shift their strategies as well. I am joined today by Dr. Joseph Allen. He's director of the Healthy Buildings Program at the Harvard School of Public Health. Celine Gounder also joins us as well. She's an infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist at NYU, host of the Epidemic and American Diagnosis podcast, and a member of the Biden-Harris Transition COVID-19 Advisory Board. So, Dr. Gounder, let me pick up with that for a second here. Is it fair to say, I personally right now, you heard me earlier talk about my struggles with Dr. Fauci, but I am quite mystified by what the Biden administration's goals are for pandemic control or COVID control. Is that, am I justified in feeling mystified or not?
Meghna, I think you're not the only one. Many of us have asked, you know, what is it that we're trying to accomplish? So first of all, what are the limitations of the tools that you have? What can you accomplish realistically with those tools? And then what are the metrics? So are we trying to prevent infections and transmission? Well, the vaccines are not going to do that. They're not going to prevent every single infection and transmission. Are we trying to prevent symptomatic infections? Are we trying to prevent serious disease, which might land you in the hospital or death? And clearly, the administration is saying that the metric of preventing hospitalization and death is not enough. They want to do more than that. And it remains unclear. So where in the middle between preventing transmission and preventing hospitalization are they going to land?
So when you were on the transition advisory board, the COVID transition advisory board for the Biden-Harris team, that was a long time ago, right? It was much, much, much earlier this year. So or actually late last year. So different point in the pandemic. But can you take us into some of the conversations there? I mean, was there sort of a sense of like, here are the kinds of goals, metrics, or strategies we're going to be aiming for?
Well, so this was between November and late January. And at that time, you know, we walked into a situation, we're walking into a situation where there was really no plan for how to roll out the vaccine. And so it was really all hands on deck trying to figure out how do we get, make sure we have enough supply, how are we going to get that vaccine into arms? And I think there was this sort of crisis mentality of we just need to vaccinate as many people as possible. I think there was less focus on what comes on the other side of that.
Yeah. So point taken. A different time in the pandemic. But now that we have several highly effective vaccines, I'm hearing a little bit of frustration in your voice as well, Dr. Gounder, about not even if we're not even going to be aiming for particular metrics like hospitalization rates, just a general thrust of like, hey, American people, this is the direction that we want to go in. So like, if you were able to help, let's just fantasize here for a second, Dr. Gounder, if you were able to help President Biden write a sort of COVID speech right now that he would give to the American people, what would you have him say?
Well, there was a great piece published by Dr. Lucy McBride in The Atlantic over the weekend. She calls it a COVID serenity prayer. And I really wish I had written this myself. It's really quite eloquent. And she says, we need the serenity to accept the things we cannot change. So we cannot change that COVID is here to stay. We cannot change that SARS-CoV-2 cannot be eliminated. The virus will become endemic, which means there's going to be some level of ongoing community transmission. But we need to have the courage to change the things we can. And as she says, the wisdom to know the difference. So what can we change? We need to get more people vaccinated. Again, aiming for that 80 to 85% I talked about. We need to maximize our use of testing, of ventilation and air filtration. We need to be tailoring some of our measures based on risk. So what makes sense for a nursing home resident may not be what makes sense for a 20-something. But some of those people might want to be using masks indoors on an ongoing basis. We also need to do a much better job of supporting our caregivers, providing sick leave, paid sick leave, and providing disability benefits and treatment and care for patients who do end up with long COVID. So there are a lot of things we could be doing differently, and we need to be investing in things like public health across the board.
Dr. Allen, thanks for listening patiently here, but what's your take on what Dr. Gounder just said? Would you like President Biden to offer that COVID serenity prayer as a start?
Yeah, like something as a start in terms of metrics. And let me just say, I think Dr. Gounder has been one of the smartest most rational voices since the start of this pandemic. So it's a pleasure to join her. Let me say that CDC has actually set metrics. So the administration does have two metrics. I think they're faulty for a lot of reasons. And I wrote about this in the Washington Post last week. The first is number of cases over 7 days per 100,000. Well, this is a faulty metric because we shouldn't be tracking cases. Cases start to decouple when you have a highly vaccinated population. And a case in a 45-year-old is very different than a case in a young 20-year-old. Second, they use a percent positivity approach. This is becoming extremely problematic, especially with the rise of rapid tests. If I take a rapid test at home and I'm negative, I don't get counted in that denominator. If I am positive, I go take a confirmatory test and that gets counted. So we do actually have two metrics. And quite curious to me is that the CDC has tied these metrics to levels around the country. You're either in a substantial or a high spread. Most of the country's in those zones. And that governs masking policy for adults. But curiously, they didn't tie those to masking for kids in schools. So this is leading to a lot of the confusion. There are metrics out there. They're faulty. These are well-known flaws in these two metrics. That's the metric we're using. I don't think it's the appropriate one. I think we should be using these metrics that are tied to severe disease and death. And like Denmark did, they're at 75% vaccinated. They're lifting restrictions because, quote, COVID is no longer a critical threat to society. That's the metric they're using. So I think we need to be a lot more clear about these metrics. There are two metrics out there. They're both faulty and known to be faulty, and they're more problematic as more people get vaccinated.
Okay, Joe Allen. So now we're getting to a place where my COVID-exhausted brain can start to understand what we might aim for. So let us be clear here. Is that sort of a plan that you're offering or that you'd like to see the United States move towards? Again, the higher vaccination rates, extremely important. Both you and Dr. Gounder talked about wanting to get above 80%. And then if we have to look for other metrics as ways to figure out, like, if we're heading in the right direction, hospitalization and death rates, is that what you're saying, Dr. Allen?
Yeah, I actually think we need to do two things to get us there in terms, and these determine how bad it will be. But first, we have to clearly increase the vaccination rates. This is where we have to have mandates. Look what's happening in New York City. I wrote a piece in Washington Post in early August. 50% of the NYPD, NYFD, Corrections, Department of Ed were vaccinated at that point. Only one of those groups had a mandate, Department of Education. They're at 95%. Those other groups are still at 50%. The path out of this is the vaccines. We have to push on these vaccine mandates to get these vaccination rates as high as Dr. Gounder said in the beginning, above 80%. That's a must. Two, I like the rollout of these rapid tests. These should have been out a year ago. This is our path to know if you're actively infectious and can help free up society and bring back things like Broadway, the performing arts, going back to restaurants where we can feel safe. Three, I think really importantly is that for those who are still concerned, right? We've all experienced this pandemic in different ways. There's still something you can do. It's still okay to wear a mask. You should upgrade to a higher mask. You can get a booster shot, which provides you some extra protection. So it's not just that we say we're going to let it rip at this point. We're highly vaccinated. We should continue to push those vaccinations. We should use the other tools available to us. Rapid tests, better masks for those who want to wear that better mask, even if they're vaccinated. And on top of that, yes, of course, we need these healthy building strategies like better ventilation filtration that we should have had for a long time. When we do all of that, then yes, COVID is no longer a critical threat to society.
Okay, so follow up again. I apologize to both of you because really, I just we've been engaging with this for so long that sometimes I just lose sight of to how to fully understand what the next step should be. So, at the risk of oversimplification, Dr. Allen, say I'm thinking of ideal scenario. Like, say there, I'll just pick a state. Illinois. Let's just pick Illinois. Say Illinois reached a situation where they were above 80% vaccination, right? Maybe even 85, and that their COVID hospitalization and death rate were at similar to say the flu. Okay, and their hospital system was not overwhelmed. Would we say that, you know, like, Illinois, folks in Illinois, you should be living your normal lives right now, a la Denmark?
My answer would be yes, and I'll put one asterisk on that. If you're vaccinated, then absolutely yes, because the threat to you is quite low. If you're unvaccinated, Delta is going to find you. It is highly transmissible. So you need to get vaccinated. If you don't, you are taking a significant risk. But, you know, at that point, if we're above 80%, healthcare system is functioning, we don't have a lot of hospitalizations, then absolutely we should start to get back to normal.
Okay, so Dr. Gounder, what do you think about that?
I agree with what Dr. Allen just said. I think the only other second asterisk, so to speak, that I would add to that is there are some people, especially the elderly, people living in nursing homes, people who are highly immunocompromised, who may still need to do things like continuing to mask, especially in cough, cold, flu, and now COVID season. But I think if we can hit that 80 to 85% vaccination coverage and you are vaccinated, most people can return to a pretty normal life.
So I was about to say, aside from the political challenges in the United States, but I can't brush those aside, right? I mean, is that really one of the things that's preventing us from reaching what seems to be now, at least in my mind, a definable set of goals, Dr. Gounder?
Oh, yeah. I think the fact that this has been a politicized pandemic from the beginning has really hampered our response and continues to do so. I mean, you can see in other countries where they have successfully avoided politicizing the pandemic. Countries like Portugal, like Denmark, they have achieved very high vaccination coverage. And I think, unfortunately, we are in a place where people are just becoming more and more entrenched in their views. And this speaks to the need for, as Dr. Allen noted, vaccine mandates. Those kinds of requirements may be the only way to overcome that.
So let me fact check something with both of you here. I've been trying to look back into sort of pandemics past, and granted, it's been a century since we've had a big global pandemic like this one. But has there, other than smallpox? I mean, has there ever been a globally widespread disease that we've completely eliminated, that so that the goal of elimination, has it been possible in the past, Dr. Gounder?
So the only disease that we have ever, human disease that we've ever eradicated is smallpox. We have been trying to eliminate, or rather eradicate, polio for years now and still have not done so successfully. And so I think the understanding that the threshold to eradicate or even eliminate, and there's a slight difference there, a disease, it's very high bar. And the fact that we now have an even more infectious SARS-CoV-2 with a Delta variant makes that exceedingly difficult to do. It's not that in an ideal world we wouldn't want to. It's just that simply our tools are not going to allow us to.
Okay. I appreciate that fact check, because that's what I was thinking too. Like, I couldn't other than smallpox, think of something else that we've completely or at least almost gotten down to total zero. And the reason why I say that is because, Dr. Gounder, in a piece that you had recently in The Atlantic, you talked about Americans having to recalibrate expectations. I mean, I think people worldwide have to recalibrate expectations. So one of them is that we can live safely and healthily and normally, even with COVID sort of still floating around in some way. I just want to state that. That is a possibility, right, Dr. Gounder?
Well, and this is where vaccination is so important, because even if you do end up with a breakthrough infection, we can massively reduce the severity of disease by vaccination. So in a sense, transforming through vaccination COVID into something more like the flu.
Okay. So Joe Allen, then, we've talked about the ways we can get there. How about the ways that these goals are communicated to people? Because I'm still fascinated by the fact that Dale Fisher in Singapore said, in part because they were so successful in communicating risks in Singapore early in the pandemic, they have the opposite problem now. They have a highly sensitized population there that gets really concerned over even their relatively small number of cases in Singapore. So how would you, what would you say to the American people right now, Joe Allen, about what we ought to do next? What's realistic, you know, of what sacrifices we should make, what sacrifices we don't have to make anymore?
Yeah, I think this is what Dr. Jenkins, I wrote about in the New York Times, is leading to a lot of this confusion, is that, again, it's the goal setting part and people are confused. And even when you hear guidance from experts and it sounds different, some people were arguing to close schools in August. I think that was really a foolish position to take. But if you step back and understand that person's goals, well, if their goal was zero COVID, then maybe to them that makes sense. But the reality is this is something we're going to live with. We can live with it. We actually have the tools to live with it in such a way that it doesn't cause the problem we were guarding against, which was a collapse of society, a collapse of our healthcare system. In highly vaccinated places, for example, in the Northeast, we're not at that point. So I feel it is time to start loosening some of this. The piece I wrote in the Washington Post last week was about this. I still think people are so concerned that even when it's a fully vaccinated environment, like an office building with everyone vaccinated or a university campus, we're still masking indoors. To me, that does not make sense. That's sending that message, this anxiety-producing message, when actually we know from the science that actually it's a very low-risk environment at that point. And we're not communicating that.
Well, Joe Allen is director of the Healthy Buildings Program and an associate professor at Harvard School of Public Health, the Chan School of Public Health. Joe Allen, thank you as always. And Celine Gounder, infectious disease specialist at NYU, host of the Epidemic and American Diagnosis podcast. Dr. Gounder, thank you so much. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard And he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.